The first report in an ongoing clinical trial suggests that the children of mothers who get financial assistance have stronger brain development early in life.
A number of developmental dimensions, cognitive development, socio-emotional development.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from one of the study's authors. We'll also explore college student mental health as they return to in-person classes and spend an academic minute with an out-of-the-box mental health treatment. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. With extending the child care tax credit still a big topic in the news, a report from an ongoing clinical trial suggests that children of mothers who get regular cash assistance have enhanced brain development, and the more cash, the better. The research article was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and it's called The Impact of a Poverty Reduction Intervention on Infant Brain Activity. It's the first year report in a 4-year study. Here to talk about this study is one of the authors of the article. Dr. Greg Duncan is an economist and a distinguished professor in the School of Education at the University of California, Irvine. We started by talking about the beginnings of this study.
Well, you know, I've been interested in this for quite a long time. Back in the early 90s, I became interested in the extent to which income had an effect on children's development. I think there was a lot of evidence even back then that kids growing up in low-income families ended up, on average, doing worse than kids growing up in higher-income families. You know, some poor kids did just fine and were very successful, but on average, there was that relationship, and it was always controversial to what extent income was the active ingredient behind those associations. Some would say, yes, all we have to do is give low-income families more income, but other people would say, no, it's not income, it's single-parent family structure, it's culture, you know, you name it. So in order to resolve this question of the extent to which income is an active ingredient in affecting low-income children's development, you need a clinical trial. You need to be randomly assigning families with kids to two groups. You know, you don't want to do a random assignment of some people into poverty, but what we came up with was a design that would randomly assign families, all of whom would get additional money, but some would get larger amounts than others. And what we settled on were monthly amounts of $333 for at least 4 years. We haven't figured out what the ending's going to be, versus $20 for that same period of time. So it was either $4,000 a year or $240 a year paid monthly. And I must say, we started out planning for this and raising money for it back in 2011, you know, long before there was any discussion of expanding the earned income tax credit or, you know, any sort of policy angle to this. But it was it's a scientific study to try to resolve the extent to which income is an active ingredient for children's healthy development.
And you gave this money with no strings attached. You said, here's the money, do what you will, right?
That's exactly right. So the wonderful mothers who are participating in our study gave birth in 4 different metropolitan areas, New York, Twin Cities, Omaha, and New Orleans. And shortly after they gave birth, still in the birth hospitals, about to be released, we approached them to see if they were willing, interested in participating in a research project. And, you know, many of them said no, some of them said yes. And then we screened for mothers whose family incomes were below the poverty line. So all the mothers in our study are low income. And at the end of that process of providing that information, we again asked them if they were interested in participating in what amounted to a lottery. And then we determined by flipping a coin, basically, whether they would get a debit card with $333 loaded up on it in the hospital versus a debit card with only $20 loaded up on it. And then month after month after month, we would keep loading up those amounts. And then we planned the research, which would visit the families after 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And the research that we reported on comes from the age one visit, home visit, where when the kids were 12 months of age.
Were these all single mothers?
No, these were any mothers with family incomes below the poverty line. So some were married, some had partners, at least around the time of birth. Some of them, this was their first child, sometimes their second child or third child. We didn't impose any restrictions on the demographic composition of the sample. And, you know, the fact that it was New York and New Orleans and Omaha and the Twin Cities provided a very diverse, in terms of racial, ethnic composition sample. I think the moms on average were about 26 years of age, about 40% or so were African-American, about 40% were Hispanic. So, you know, all were low income, average education was about 12 years of education. So, you know, it's a low income group, but we didn't impose any restrictions beyond family income being below the poverty line.
And could you say what researchers were looking for when they took a look at these results? Were you looking for physical differences, for developmental differences, behavioral differences, just something societal? What were the goals?
Well, our interest is in the extent to which kids in these two different groups differ along a number of developmental dimensions, cognitive development, socio-emotional development. So by the time we're done, we'll be gathering a lot of that kind of information. But at age 12 months, you're much more limited in the kind of information that you can gather from the infants. And it turns out that this EEG measurement, the electrical activity in the brain, is one thing that you can measure reliably in infants. And we had to do a lot of work to be able to take portable machines into homes to explain to the mothers what we'd be doing. And it involves putting a cap on the infant with 20 different electrodes scattered around. You know, some 12-month-olds just don't want anything put on their head. And so not all of them were part of the contributing data to the study that we talked about, but most of them were fine. And the kids would just sit on their mother's laps quietly for up to 5 minutes. And we would monitor the amount of electrical activity that was being recorded in these little electrodes that were resting against their scalp.
Now, you can go online and take a look at some of these pictures from those scans. And I mean, I don't know what I'm looking at, but you can see definite differences between the two groups.
Yeah. And we really didn't know whether we would find anything. When we were planning the study, we planned it as at least 3 years of payments. So, you know, age one is a little like trying to reach conclusions about what it's like to be in college after your freshman year. Hmm. So it's an early point. But we went ahead and did the assessments. And what we were looking for were group differences. You know, there's a lot of variation within each group. But are there group differences in the amount of high-frequency electrical activity? That's one thing you can measure. And are there group differences in low-frequency electrical activity? And if you look at I'm an economist, so I'm trying to talk about neuroscience here, but my understanding is that a lot of studies have shown that low-frequency power is associated with developmental delays and other kinds of problematic development. But high frequency power is associated with better cognitive development later on in childhood. So we were trying to see, we hypothesized that the two groups would differ in both low frequency power and high frequency power, that the high cash group kids would have less low frequency power and more high frequency power. And the results showed that there were not reliable differences with low frequency power, but there were reliable differences in high frequency power between the two different groups. And that's what the article really focuses on.
You finally got to do your study that you'd been planning for and raising money for almost a decade, and boof, you started in the middle of a pandemic. Did COVID put any monkey wrenches in this?
Well, it did, but not for the study that we reported on. You know, when we did our study, we recruited 1,000 mothers over the course of a year. So, you know, our age one assessments that included the EEG began in July of 2019 as kids turned 1 year of age and continued through March 10th of 2020. And that's when, you know, all personal visits had to stop because of COVID. So our data that we report on was gathered for about two thirds of the mothers whose kids had birthdays before March 10th. And at that point we had to switch to telephone, and then it was impossible to go into the home and do these EEG measurements. So it affected us in cutting down the number of kids that we were able to assess, but it didn't really affect any of the comparisons that we're trying to make between the high cash group kids and the low cash group kids.
This is a 4 year study, as you said. Is there any thought of maybe saying, you know, this is really interesting, let's bump it up to 5, 6, or 7 when they start school?
You know, when I started out in 1972 working on a 5 year study, that was supposed to be the end, and it was a very successful study, and the study is still going on today.
Okay.
So it's, you know, it's almost 60 years old. So never say never when you have an interesting study. And, you know, ours is very interesting because it's really the only clinical trial where you're distributing different amounts of cash to the two groups. If, you know, if we find differences at age 4, our current plan, we're trying to extend the study at least until age 8. Then, you know, depending on what we find, our funders, potential funders, will either be more, and we will be either more or less interested in keeping going. So if these differences show up as strongly or more strongly at age 4, then, you know, it's really trying to address this question of whether early childhood is a particularly important time in development, and are kids' early environments particularly important in either getting kids off on a positive track or a less positive track. So, and you really want to know just not, you know, how they're doing in school, but ultimately you really want to know whether, say, programs that are paying economic resources to low-income families, whether the kids are benefiting in a way that will enable them to grow up and be more successful adults, right? We really want the next generation to be entering adulthood and be productive workers and pay our Social Security and, you know, all sorts of other good stuff that represents continuing the national prosperity that we've enjoyed for so many years.
Still to come, our conversation with Greg Duncan continues with a look at how this study may answer some political questions that keep coming up. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest is Dr. Greg Duncan, an economist and a distinguished professor at the School of Education at the University of California, Irvine. We're talking about a research article he co-authored called The Impact of a Poverty Reduction Intervention on Infant Brain Activity. As we were wrapping up our conversation, he pointed out that the study seems especially topical today, with talk of trying to renew the monthly child tax credits that expired at the beginning of the year.
right? That's a big part of the Build Back Better legislation that's now being considered, and it's about to be chopped up, I think. Some people are saying we should keep the child tax credit, and some people are saying, you know, it's too expensive and it's going to lead to less work and drugs and all sorts of bad stuff. And, you know, this is what we're providing is some evidence for the discussion. And I think it's important to have this discussion, and people can certainly have different points of view about it. But, you know, as in most policy discussions, what needs to be put on the table is both evidence about the potential costs of a program, as well as the potential benefits of the program. So, you know, way back for the history of welfare programs, there's been a lot of focus, and this is true for research too, on the potential costs of providing income to low-income families, costs in terms of less work, costs in terms of how the money is spent, you know, costs in terms of whether children are more likely to be growing up in families where no adult is working and they come to view a life with no work as being perfectly feasible for them. So those are the cost concerns. We'll be able to say something about some of those things, and there's been a lot of research about those things. What's been neglected, relatively speaking, is the benefit side, the child benefit side, right? To what extent is providing economic resources to families through these kinds of programs benefiting the kids? And that's what our study is focused on. There's really been quite a bit of research on this, pretty good research over the last 15 years or so. And, you know, for what happened to kids when the earned income tax credit was expanded in the 1990s, what happened to kids when the food stamp program was rolled out in the 1970s. That research, by and large, shows that kids do benefit from higher family incomes, that income does seem to be an active ingredient for them in ways that show up with more cognitive performance on achievement tests. But even into adulthood, you can look at adult health and adult earnings and things like that, and you can get these kind of links. So I think it's important for people to think about these programs in light of both costs and benefits. And depending on how people think about costs and benefits, they may end up thinking that they're still not good ideas because the costs outweigh the benefits. But I think it's at least important to try to put as much information about the potential benefits from these programs on the table as possible. And I really see our study as doing exactly that.
As we said earlier, the money is given with no strings attached. But after the first year, do you ask what they're doing with the money?
We do ask the mothers in every annual interview what their rent is, how much they're spending on groceries, how much they're spending on expenditures for kids, books and toys and diapers for the infants. But we also actually ask about expenditures on alcohol and tobacco, the kind of things that some of the stereotypes in the political discussions focus on. So we're trying to get a fairly comprehensive picture on what their expenditures are looking like and whether there are group differences in expenditures between the high and low income or high cash group and low cash group families. You know, we're trying to only report out studies that have gone through peer review and are published. And that was the case with the EEG study. And we're hoping it won't be that long before we'll have our first paper out describing differences in work and expenditures and things like that.
Well, I think it'd be fascinating to hear how this goes in another 12 months and 12 months beyond that, because it seems that you're onto something. It's really making a difference.
We're thinking that that's what the data do show. You know, researchers are pretty cautious by nature, and it could be that, you know, once we do our big age 4 laboratory visit where the kids come in and get an EEG and so forth, after 4 years of payments, that we're not going to find anything. But this early difference that we're finding after 12 months is certainly increasing our expectations that we may well find something as we continue to follow these kids and continue to look for these group differences.
Greg Duncan is a distinguished professor at the School of Education at the University of California, Irvine. The article he co-authored called The Impact of a Poverty Reduction Intervention on Infant Brain Activity is available online in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. After starting their college courses online due to the pandemic, many current college sophomores are having a difficult time adjusting to fully in-person instruction. As Alex Malinowski reports from Syracuse University, some students feel the abrupt transition is taking a major toll on their mental health.
College is often touted as the best 4 years of a student's life. However, the dream of a normal college experience quickly faded away for 2020 high school graduates as COVID-19 wreaked havoc across the country. Many students began their college experience by taking remote classes.
I am so excited for this semester to teach you about the principles of financial accounting.
Some never even left their homes or dorms. But Syracuse University sophomore April Santana says remote learning wasn't all bad.
There were more open notes exams, and that made everything 100% easier because, like I said before, I didn't have to study.
But most students are back at school taking in-person classes, and it hasn't been easy. Santana notes her attention span isn't what it used to be.
Just being in person and having to pay attention for an hour and 20 minutes without a break or anything, like, that's been super difficult.
Santana is not the only one struggling. Georgia Tech sophomore Walter Ellsworth says he is now taking a gap semester following a tumultuous second semester of primarily in-person classes coupled with a nagging medical issue.
Trying to juggle more advanced college classes when there's, like, harder things going on and you're, you know, pushed to, you know, separate yourself from other people. It definitely didn't make everything easier. It made everything a lot more difficult, and it definitely made me a lot more of a sad person than what I used to be.
Ellsworth says there's a connection between mental health and academic performance that so many students can relate to.
I get why a lot of young people feel hopeless at times when they feel like they've fallen so far behind when things look really grim for their future. Because sometimes the future looks like it's irreparable, like there's no way to fix their current situation.
According to Mental Health America, suicide is still the second leading cause of death of youth ages 10 to 24. Family education specialist at the Mental Health Association in New York State, Whitney Clausen, says the stigma surrounding mental health continues to keep young people, including college students, from seeking help.
Unfortunately, anything kind of above the head has this, or above the shoulders has this stigma around it, like, don't talk about it, don't ask about it sort of thing.
Clausen says it can be very difficult for students to ask for help in a fast-paced, cutthroat environment where not being okay is considered a weakness. But taking that first step can make all the difference.
Asking for help, it's not, doesn't have to be something that people go through alone, I think is really the message I hope people understand.
Clausen says colleges are attempting to staff up student health services and create a more welcoming environment for students.
Making sure that the counseling centers are warm and inviting and that the staff are pleasant and that the experience is positive, so when students do go, they're likely to come back. Because we know that first experience is so important, and we want to make sure that that experience is positive for people so they can continue to do the work. So,
while strengthening student health services is crucial, sophomore Walter Ellsworth says support from professors is just as important. Ellsworth found his professors to be sympathetic and forgiving as he struggled to navigate his classes with so much going on in his personal life.
They just gave me extensions on my assignments. They gave me times that I could call them for office hours and extra office hours if I needed help because I was falling behind. And they told me extra lesson plans that I could look at for stuff that I didn't fully understand. And them giving me extra time and them understanding that I wanted to do the work was a huge thing.
Despite efforts to provide help, the stigma continues to leave many students hesitant to take advantage of them. Ellsworth says one of his peers at Georgia Tech took her own life before reaching out for help after the pressures of the pandemic and advanced classwork at this top school got to be too much.
If you fall behind, it feels incredibly overwhelming. Like you feel like the world is crashing around you and you can't claw your way out. And I sympathize a lot with that feeling, and I empathize a lot with her.
While this case is extreme, it's another example of the pressure some college students are feeling these days as they try to adjust to being back in the classroom, where workloads are usually higher than they are for online courses. Colleges are trying to provide whatever help students need to avoid being overcome by the transition. But many students indicate they are still stressed beyond anything they've ever experienced. I'm Alex Malinowski.
Some doctors are experimenting with street drugs to treat their PTSD patients. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Treating mental disorders may require some out-of-the-box thinking. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the American Association of Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, C. Michael White, distinguished professor and chair of pharmacy practice at the University of Connecticut, discusses a form of treatment that is gaining steam with positive results.
MDMA is an active ingredient in the street drugs ecstasy or Molly. People in dance clubs or raves like the surreal feeling they get from MDMA's psychedelic effects, the improved mood from serotonin release, and the feeling of bonding to strangers from oxytocin release. Investigators hypothesize that these same effects would benefit people with post-traumatic stress disorder who struggle to share their traumatic events or work through them with psychotherapists. We recently completed a meta-analysis statistically pooling all the trials assessing MDMA-assisted psychotherapy with psychotherapy alone. Patients receiving MDMA-assisted psychotherapy reduced the severity of their PTSD symptoms by 22 points and were twice as likely to no longer meet the definition of PTSD by the end of the study. Furthermore, 1 year after having their last MDMA-assisted psychotherapy session, 86% of participants said they received substantial benefits from the combined MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. 71% had fewer nightmares, 69% had less anxiety, and 66% had improved sleep. However, people cannot replicate these benefits by trying illicit MDMA on their own. First off, most ecstasy or Molly tablets have other drugs of abuse in them, like LSD or methamphetamine, which enhances the risks. Second, it isn't MDMA alone that works. It is MDMA allowing people to feel comfortable enough with their psychotherapist to reveal and work through their traumatic events with less pain or anxiety. So, for the half of patients with PTSD not fully benefiting from psychotherapy alone, adding two or three MDMA-assisted psychotherapy sessions to the mix can make a big difference.
That was C. Michael White of the University of Connecticut. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.